Fortunately, the batteries died out right in the middle of Smith and before we got to the stadial theory, which is where we ended. A theory with both synchronous and diachronous characteristics, both verticality and horizontality. Anyway, this tape will pick it up from there as we go from Smith to Darwin and into Coon. Pretty amazing, eh? Well, look, we ended up last time with my saying that what you've got with Adam Smith is an example of typical Enlightenment thought. It's probably a very simple example. The French philosophe, like beginning, let's say, with Montesquieu and many others, who understand themselves to be doing what they call the economic and moral sciences. In the French Enlightenment, there's very sophisticated speculation about historical and social development. This is the point of Montesquieu's Spirit of the Laws. And if you want to know all about this stuff, you should take History 400.
The percentage of it?
No. Yeah, under charges a buck more per handout. And gives it to me. Right. And my mother pays him to be my friend. So it all works out. Adam Smith, what you have there in the little snippets from The Wealth of Nations is fairly simple stuff. It does get a great deal more complicated. Perhaps the absolute zenith of all of this is, I forgot his name. Oh, Fourier, who, in speculating about human nature and social relations, and designing, therefore, the ideal community, posits some 769 specific identifiable passions, which are innate in us, and need to be satisfied in their measure. And in the ideal community, they are, to the degree they should be, and everybody's absolutely happy. This is utopian socialism, as Marx sneered at one point. Anyway, but what does typify it is that business that I said you do see in Smith, the business of looking at the social world in a way that at many points is analogous to the Newtonian explanation of the physical world. Individual atoms with innate properties which then interact in a way that is in some sense mechanical. Or if it's not mechanical, interact in ways which surprisingly enough seem to be quantifiable. The idea of a market, the idea of society as a market, Professor McPherson wants to say, begins articulately with Hobbes, but it doesn't begin articulately with Hobbes, and it certainly does in many ways with Smith. And we saw how with Smith's analysis there's a push, not an insistence, and in many ways in his theory of moral sentiments, where Smith is also the author, there's considerable evidence that he's not merely this crass. But there's certainly a push to which the more weak-minded may succumb, or the less sensitive, or something, or the something or other. A push towards a kind of commoditization of everything. It's almost as if you can't put a price tag on it, it's not real, or it's not somehow considerable. That is, it somehow can't enter into the analysis. And, as I suggested in this kind of fairly adequate sketch of all this, overarching all this is the business of rational self-consciousness is asking these questions about itself, to itself, right? This is the social order, we're the actors in it. And overarching all this is the is an answer that we are at our best, or we are most naturally what we are, or we are in accord with our natures, the more we act as if we know we are actors in such a system, right? And that's what rational conduct looks like. And it seems to be that's an adequate way to gloss Smith's exhortative business about rational self-interest. A reasonable person will make sure to conduct himself or herself according to these principles or maxims. And Smith wants to demonstrate, as a kind of theorem, if this happens, and when this happens, we are all better off. At least in the sense, notice this could be a minimal sense, at least in the sense of increasing the resources at our command. Now, when Adam Smith wrote The Theory of Moral Sentiments, he posed, for scholars anyway, something the Germans called Das Adam Smith Problem, which is exactly what they call it too, which is, how could the same guy write both books? There's a similar, though not named, problem about John Locke, The Treatise of Government, and the Essay on Human Understanding, but that's less exciting somehow. In The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which I have not studied and so really only have gossip about, of which I bloody well ought to study one day soon, and here's why, Smith engages in part in a kind of speculative anthropology, sort of speculative philosophical anthropology, about the origin and place in human life of moral sentiments. And my suspicion is that this treatise is indeed, in some sense, a starting point for Charles Darwin's speculation about the origin of, he doesn't call them moral sentiments, what does he call them? Maybe he just, moral sense. I think that's what he calls it, moral sense. So I guess what I'm saying is there is, at least skimming on the surface, quite a bit of continuity from the new world of Hobbes and Newton to through into the modern world of Adam Smith, Charles Darwin, and if we had another few months, we could probably push it right into 20th century social theory, modern sociology. Much of modern sociology, as you know, indeed, the kind of sociology that's usually labeled as small l liberal, is this kind of atomistic social atoms sociology, in the sense that it adopts what is usually called individualism, and in a sense, in a way, is not as sensitive as some would like it to the notion that the social order is not made up of fully formed human individuals. Remember, we noticed that kind of problem with Hobbes and Locke, these great contract theorists, that they imagine civil society to be composed, to be authored indeed, by a pact between fully formed human persons, right? Fully human already, And we notice the contrast between that and what I guess we would call classical political theory, namely that theory that's roughly Aristotelian, although perhaps by now you might have noticed it's also sort of Hegelian or sort of Marxist, that it's just a mistake. So the opposition would claim, or the contrary would claim, to imagine that civil society, the political community in which we become persons, is somehow something that comes after persons. In other words, the critique would be exactly that of Aristotle, that the political community is prior to persons. It's within that community that persons are made. And, as you can see, this kind of analysis is in one sense as old as Plato. At the end of the Republic is a section called The Decline of the Ideal State. And it talks about, in a way that in some senses seems very modern, it talks about different, what the Greeks called constitutions, what we could call ways, what we would mean by ways of life, or type of society. Somebody said liberal democratic society, specifying a kind of peculiar blend of socialist and capitalist economy, democratic politics, the sort we're used to, types of society, and the types of personalities, the types of characters that will predominate in that kind of society because of the kind of society it is. That is, a particular social or political order, in a sense, carries with it scripts for major actors. And this is really the sort of thing Plato engages in by talking about the kind of interaction between dominant characters and a kind of social order, the tensions between the two, and how this tension, in fact, is almost a contradiction, resolves itself by the emergence of another kind of social order, which then has its major characters. And this is the decline of the ideal state. But the point that's noticed there, as in much of modern critical theory, is the idea that types of social orders, if there are such things, generate, indeed create, the persons that inhabit them to some degree, carry with them scripts, if you want, provide the dramatic narrative, if you want, for the lives of its dominant individuals. So, one way to look at, and this is a way that some contemporary theorists explore, one way to look at that business of the polis is prior to the person is by one route looking at what might be called social role theory. Ben David gave us one example of that, how a particular kind of social scene allows for the creation or emergence of new roles, and how, in very much the same ways, particular scenes will sustain some roles and not others. One way to look at it is social role theory, but another way to look at it, which appeals more, I think, to historians and people more sensitive to literature, might be to look at it more in terms of narratives. This is McIntyre's line. Look at it more in terms of dramatic narratives, scripts which people are both authoring and enacting. Anyhow, what I was saying was, as we kind of skim over the surface, although there are lots and lots of deep and interesting problems which you can explore in history 400 at least skimming over the surface, one can see a kind of continuity from Hobbes and Newton into the modern age, and that conceptually the new science makes quite a bit of difference, providing at least a kind of background against which people can, or in terms of which, if you want, people can take for granted, however subliminally, answers to questions like, what sort of a cosmos, what sort of a universe are we in, what kinds of creatures are we anyhow, and begin to work out answers to these old questions about the nature of human nature and the social order. So, for example, overarching all those 300 years from Hobbes and Newton till now has been, however unstated and however unanalyzed, a fairly firm conviction, particularly on the part of those making for what almost everyone calls, whether they know what they're talking about or not, what almost everyone calls progress, has been the conviction that whatever else is true, it's true that there ain't nothing in the world but matter and motion. In other words, a materialist conviction. That it is in terms of that kind of final and ultimate truth that physics, in some sense, is at the bottom of it all. In terms of that conviction, we have to fill in the rest of the story. Anyway, let's say a few things about Darwin, and then we can, well, Darwin and Marx, I guess. Although, in a way, Marx will be better to bring up next time, because it's easier to fit him into discussion about the impact of what's sometimes called the impact of technology on society. There's two things about Darwin worth talking about, really, if one breaks it down. One is the origin of species problem, and the other is this question about the descent of man. Let me just indicate a few things about the origin of species problem. One way to see what Darwin's up against is, a couple of guidelines. What's going on by the time Darwin is a naturalist, to sum it up and to put it all in one package, is one thing that's going on is work on what might be called the history of the earth. You see, once you have the mechanical philosophy, forget whether it's a Copernican or a Ptolemaic astronomy, although as we've noticed it may be that the mechanical philosophy goes better with the Copernican astronomy, Once you have the mechanical philosophy, or just Newtonianism, you are then in a position to ask the question that would never be a question with Aristotle or the Aristotelians for obvious reasons. A question such as, what is the history of the solar system? Now, it's possible that God just went, and there you go, the sun and the planets and so on. But it's also possible, and remember, let me remind you about Descartes' imaginary. It's also possible that the world as we know it came into being through the interaction of bits of matter obeying laws of motion and did not begin as we find it. Right? That, remember Descartes' imaginary history, that in the beginning God just creates matter, which is to say all of space, and then gives it motion. Also, somewhere in the back of God's mind are laws of motion this matter will obey. And then Descartes says in Le Monde, in this imaginary history of the universe, that giving this plenum all the matter there is motion means that it's got to break up and form fluid, all kinds of fluid motions, and these are all various whirlpools or vortices of one kind or another, and hence arises the phenomenon. And any system of revolving junk made out of third matter, which means planets, is going to have, if it's big enough, a sun at the middle, because remember, the middle of such a system is in a region of great pressure, so when you aim your eye that way, you see light. So solar systems are inevitable once you get a whirlpool that's big enough. It's got to be bright at the middle, okay?
But no, it's almost true in some sense too. I mean, if you have any swirling body, you're going to get a large collection of matter in the middle.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, similar, this is a line of thought that with modifications is, still the kind of thing people like to say is true. But notice how built into this, if there's nothing but matter in motion, then in a way that is not quite real for an Aristotelian, the universe might have a history, not only in the large, but of course in each of its parts. And so not only could one ask about the origin or the history of the solar system, but particularly if there's such a thing as the history of the solar system, i.e. once upon a time there wasn't an Earth, then of course there's a question called the history of the Earth. Right? And so something resembling modern geology, well, something resembling what we call geology, starts getting done by the same kind of people who do natural history or botany or any other kind of collecting. But notice how a society which is vigorously pursuing industrialization, that is, mining, cutting canals, and various earth-moving operations, get into geological data in a way that an agricultural and more passive with respect to the earth kind of society would. So in fact, all kinds of stuff about the history of the earth, or let's just say natural history of the earth in that way that's sort of vague, that doesn't necessarily imply dynamic change. Right, natural history could just mean taxonomy. Let's look at the rocks, what kinds of rocks and where. Right, that same kind of bug hunting, butterflies, rocks, whatever. A great deal of information is just found out about kinds of rocks and stuff, simply by cutting canals, or later on cutting railroad grades. And as you know, by cutting interstates and trans-Canada highways, you expose all kinds of geological stuff that you'd otherwise simply not know about. And draining swamps in order to create more arable land, and all this kind of stuff. So people notice interesting things like there are layers of rocks, and the strata in the south of England is an awful lot like the strata in the northwest of France. And it looks like there's some kind of continuity over which there is now a bit of ocean. If you take away the ocean, so maybe once upon a time there wasn't so much ocean. And then there's all this business of what we call fossils, which, notice how Kuhnian this is. Here's a hunk of rock with a rock-like shell print. Now what the hell is this? You don't just see a fossil, right? You know, it's like this picture it's like the picture I hung up last time. You don't just see whatever it is you just see. Right. Well, you don't just see a fossil either. And although I certainly don't know as much about this as most of the other things we've talked about, some of them.
It's pretty clear that although people find pieces of rock with animal and plant forms in them, they're not fossils. If you're an Aristotelian, I think we might have mentioned this way back in May, one way to talk about this is to understand that sometimes a form, an essence, a soul, an informing power can inform the wrong stuff. So you get a piece of bone, only it's in very hard mud. Or indeed mud so hard that it's not even clay, it's rock. So here's a kind of accident. Now, this bone ought to be part of some creature, but there it is, sort of by accident. A hunk of rock got formed up that way.
It's similar to the statue.
Yeah, so it's like a statue. Now, how this happened, I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't risk anyone's career on going to find out, because there might not be much said, but it might be interesting to find out what medieval Aristotelians say about pieces of rock that have shells. Shells in them, particularly when they're from the Alps. Mm. You know, what the hell's going on here? Well, sports of nature.
They found, you know, big bones too. I mean, sometimes you can almost ignore a little shell print.
Well, you know, big bones.
You find giant dinosaur bones.
Well, I don't think anybody knows about them.
Well, didn't they find those in that time period?
I don't know.
I thought they did. Okay. They didn't really have a good explanation for what they were.
All right.
They thought that they maybe were some animals that didn't live, but it wasn't,
okay.
You know, well.
Well, in Da Vinci's time, they found a bunch of cave-based skeletons.
Is that right?
They figured they were dragons that died there.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. That was how they explained it.
And it wasn't a problem that no dragons around.
Well, they weren't around when they were.
Well, it's okay to say there be dragons here on your chart, as long as nobody's ever been there, or has been there, but isn't there now. It's pretty rough to say there's dragons down at Fort Van Alma. Because you and I can't see them.
Being there.
Right there. That's it.
Sports of nature and Aristotelian phrase?
It certainly is a late medieval phrase, sport of nature. But again, I mean, this is not something I know about, though I would like to know more, because I have so much time. The impression I have, which may be just completely stupid, is that these just aren't a problem.
Not too many people problem.
Well, they're not the kind of problem that, oh, the phases of Venus or the satellites of Jupiter are when somebody exploits them as a problem. There may be lurking in the archives some historical stuff we just don't know about that never got heroic, where there is somebody trying to be the Galileo of living things and is waving great femurs around saying, one of our best, but nobody pays any attention, or not enough. I mean, it may be that... Well, there is... You see, what I'm saying is there's a transition in here somewhere, so that all of a sudden there kind of arises this possibility of the history of the earth. You see, for a real Aristotelian, there ain't no such thing as a history of the earth. I mean, there is, although it's kind of like, oh, I don't know, I mean, it's a kind of monotonic history, that's what. I mean, it's the same damn thing all the time with variations. I mean, yes, there's droughts, and yes, there's little floods. And maybe long ago there was a real big flood. But by and large, the same stuff is going on all the time, and there's no new creatures, and no not around any more creatures. In fact, there's a pretty deep commitment to all the creatures that could exist, you know, this world being full, this principle of plenitude, which is partly a theological notion about a perfect God, either as a creator or as the mind who has all the forms in it, that everything that could be is, not just at the level of individual things, but at the ecological level of interaction. Every slot, every possible job slot for a thing is filled, right? And if it's not here, then it's somewhere else, maybe in the antipodes. So there really isn't a history there, except except, as I said, this kind of history that the world has always been like this, with variations that we all know about, local stuff. But in the 16th and 17th century, with the mechanical philosophy, and certainly after Newtonian dynamics, the history of the earth becomes a real thing. And remember, this is where Immanuel Kant, early in his life, when he thought he was a scientist, is especially clever. I mean, it is Kant who was among the first to realize, and I'm not aware of anyone raising this question before, at least before that time, that it's almost like Copernicus's question to Ptolemy, how come you got to know where the sun is every time you want to calculate a planet? Kant's question to the Copernican-Newtonian scheme is, how come all the planets are in the ecliptic? How come there's no planets rising in the north and setting in the south? In the Newtonian scheme, there's no reason why the planets should all be in pretty much the same plane, is there? None whatsoever. Newton can't explain it. And you notice nobody's jumping up and down and saying, ad hoc, ad hoc, ad hoc, you know, like they do with Ptolemy's episode. But if you ask the best Newtonian physicist in the world in 1720, why are all the planets in the same plane? The right answer is, beats me. That's where they are. So it's quite unfair to say to a good Ptolemaic astronomer, how come the center of Venus's epicycle has to be on the Earth's sun line? And beats me, that's where it is. I mean, give me a break. So, you know, it's that, I mean, Kuhn's right about this stuff. There are always these questions that nobody knows, but there's always this assumption that someday we'll know, and we're on the right track to knowing that stuff. But notice now with Newton's principles about forces, and especially gravitational forces, action at a distance between masses, all of a sudden the question can arise, think about it, if you're a Newtonian and somebody says, why are all the planets in the same plane? Maybe I'm wrong, and maybe this is obvious, but it certainly seems tempting to say the answer has to be in its origins. Right? Somehow the solar system came about in such a way that this is the outcome. And Kant is the guy who proposes this nebular hypothesis about two real big stars coming very near each other and gravitationally sucking gunk out of each other, which, oh, you see, it's not just all in the same plane, it's orbiting in the same east-west, or is it west-east? It's our, I don't know which way is north.
They're in the same direction.
But all orbiting in the same direction. Let's say, what is it? I guess it's clockwise from the time. Which way is up? Well, up is northern, right?
Right.
This is called directionism or something. Spatialism. Anyway, all going around in the same direction. It sort of cries out for a historical account. And it looks like a gravitational one would be a good one. Pull all that stuff out. Here's great globs of hot stuff. And they cool off and you get the Earth, blah, 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 all that stuff. Well, that's Kant's proposal.
Did Laplace get his name associated with that as well?
No, Laplace is earlier on. Laplace is heroic because he's the master of Newtonian mathematics, celestial dynamics, and he demonstrates
I can only tell you what it is, not how he demonstrates it, that contrary to various worries that people had, he demonstrates to the satisfaction of those who can understand it that the solar system is dynamically stable, that the various perturbations and so on over the long run, what are perturbations? Gravitational interactions between all the bodies. That over the long run they all cancel out and the system is capable of being like this forever. The Earth isn't going to spiral into the Sun or the Moon into the Earth or any of that stuff. So it basically the system oscillates around the mean state. And I think Newton, at the point this was shown, was known, or now maybe made significant again. Newton himself was concerned that, and rightly so, that if there's any matter in space at all, besides the planets, you know, ethereal vapors or whatever, no matter how subtle, I mean, maybe one particle, if these planets bump into just one particle a century, over the long run, they've got to slow down. So over the long run, the system for Newton is unstable, and he says that must be the case. He says it at a time when he's quite convinced that the universe is full of ethereal, nitro-aerial vapors and exhalations. So he's sure that on its own, the whole thing has to collapse, and everything eventually ends up in the Sun. But he says God injects new motion. Now for Newton, this may be a pretty mild thing, since, as I've argued anyway, it's very likely the real Newton thinks God is doing all of this all the time anyway. But for more simple minds, you just might imagine God as a kind of soccer player comes out every now and then, just bonk, just to keep things going. Well,
I heard some erstwhile creationists say that God's a fixed meteorite in which community.
With a pea shooter.
Or
else it would blow God
into the universe.
I don't know. Maybe God is painted himself with strange colors with his feathers in his head and he didn't blow them. Who knows? Does God look like Charles Darwin? That's the question.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Maybe he looks like George Bush.
Laplace is famous for having shown that Newton's worry isn't a worry. And I don't know how true this is, but everybody repeats it. Supposedly, the Emperor Napoleon asked him, but where is God in your scheme of things? And Laplace is supposed to have replied, I have no need of that hypothesis, which is, he's Carl Hempel way ahead of his time. Don't need any such, don't need that up there in the premise set. I would be fine without it. Anyway, but the point is history. The Earth has a history, so there's this thing called geology. And then the question of, just as the answer to how come there's a solar system and it's like it is, then there's a similar question, how come the Earth is like it is? And how do we account for all these different rocks and clays and landforms and all this geology. Especially since it looks like the way to account for it is in terms of a history. That once upon a time things weren't like this. Maybe once upon a time this was a great glowing gob of molten, who knows what. The sun's made out of. One thing you have to realize to wrap your mind around this stuff is it's only in the 20th century that people weren't quite sure that the sun was just a very hot thing. And it's like made out of the hardest coal imaginable. Well, what is it? But the sun, in fact, this is a famous moment, which would be worth a nice term paper one day.
the best of the British physicists, William Thomson and Lord Kelvin, caused a big problem for Darwin and all of his friends, because in 1870 something or other, William Thomson calculated that the sun, knowing its mass, he could calculate its mass from Newton's physics easy enough, that the sun couldn't possibly have been burning long enough to supply the amount of time that the Darwinians think they need to make evolution work. I jumped ahead of the story a bit, but, and I think Kelvin assumed it was kind of the best fuel we know of, like the hardest coal imaginable. And so how long could it burn? Not long enough. So you evolution people are in big trouble. It's not so much Darwin's in big trouble, I should back up now. The history of the Earth people, as you know, just if you have, you can, if you have skimmed Mason, there's quite a debate through the 18th and into the 19th century about the history of the Earth. Some people are quite convinced it's all volcanic. There's a volcanic history, lots of eruptions and meltings and blowings up and all this kind of stuff. And there's other people who are convinced that it's mostly flooding and sedimentation. And of course, as you can well imagine, each side has tons of evidence they're right. And I suppose it will. The way the whole thing's finally resolved, I guess, is James Hutton's theory of the Earth, but most especially Charles Lyell, who adopt a uniformitarian premise and say, no, yes, there's volcanoes, yes, there's floods, but really, one can account for all the formations we know about just supposing that forces, kinds of forces we see acting now are the ones that have always acted. So just wind and local flooding and the occasional volcano and rain and rivers and all this business can account for the geology of the Earth. Just by forces that act now, wind and weather and whatnot. The only thing is that you just give it enough time. So the uniformitarian view says, given enough time, then all these things can be understood.
Do you recall who was the biblical patron of your
kingdom? Archbishop Usher?
Usher. 4004.
Now that was in the 17th century, I think. It was a Thursday. 4004. Well, but he got it straight out of biblical history, just counting generations.
Yeah. But I don't understand the Thursday.
Oh, I'm making that up.
No, he was pretty precise. Oh, the time in the afternoon.
Oh, well, astronomy allows for the precision. And I don't know if biblical chronology, biblical history gives you enough precision to get down to the day. I don't know about the day. All right, well, he has reasons. I mean, unless you think he's a total bozo, he has reasons. And if you want, you probably can find them out. And they're probably fairly clever reasons. It'll have to be clever. How do you get to it? 2:15 in the afternoon, October 12th, 4004 BC. Has to be clever. It may be completely mad, but anyway, it's got to be clever. I think if you looked up Usher in one of the old editions of the Encyclopedia Britannica, I don't know if our library has one. I don't know, beginning when, maybe beginning 1780 or 90, when the Encyclopedia projects began, with this idea of democratic learning, or at least, well, democratic learning, spread of literacy. The Encyclopedia Britannica is a British contribution to this. From then until about, I don't know what, 1930 or something? At least through the
11th edition, the Encyclopedia Britannica does manage to get usually the best people.